listening to the Nerds Assemble podcast.
Welcome to episode 242 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
This week we are taking a poke, kind of sharp pointy stick maybe. I'm not sure what its difficulty level is to use it, whether or not I need to be a certain level to make this stick work, and kind of poking at the concept of difficulty in video games, because the last few weeks everyone seems to have, for the millionth time, relost their shit over the concept of games being adjustable for the play experience.
Shall we get on to first things first, good video game difficulty versus bad video game difficulty? Because I feel that there is a kind of sense of bad video game difficulty is when a game is unfair, like, say, for example, the controls are sluggish deliberately, or, you know, kind of very, very difficult to control by design. So I think to a certain extent, maybe the original Resident Evil titles, maybe under that, you know, tank controls. Not exactly the best ones.
Yeah. It's a bloody awful controls, that's why. Mm.
And wasn't there a War of the Worlds game that was on, like, Xbox the one time that had, like, really sluggish controls?
Oh, God.
Ooh. Yeah.
Oh, God, that thing. Because I had to review that, didn't I?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was...
And that, I mean, if the controls...
Did you like it, Emily?
The flashbacks are coming. Oh, my God.
If the controls had been better, would that have been... an easier game?
It would have been more comfortable to play. It might have been more playable. The fact that it was almost... it was really difficult to get anywhere with it, and it just kind of got frustrating after a point. It's just like, what's the point? I'm not going to get anywhere. I give up. That's pretty much what I think I pretty much ended up doing.
I think a lot did, didn't they? From what I heard about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I think the general complaint was that it was basically just terrible controls, which made it kind of unpleasant to play and cheap in a way as well. So versus, like, good video game difficulty, and I would actually argue that Resident Evil 4 is actually pretty good for that, actually.
Yeah,
wouldn't you say, Emily?
I mean, as somebody who's played that game way too many times, not as much as Skyrim. Yes, because it's a sliding difficulty. So once you've selected your difficulty, the game adjusts to how you play. And then if you play really well, it will start to come for you. And if you don't realise it's coming for you and don't adjust your play, it will get you. But at the same time, if you then get got too many times, it then ramps things down. Because you then end up with that weird situation, as I've said before, Resident Evil 4, where professional mode actually can be easier to play than normal difficulty due to how far that sliding scale goes, which is an unusual situation. And I wouldn't say that's necessarily something that makes the game more accessible.
Yeah, I've mentioned it before, but an Amiga, well, say 16-bit game, because it came out on Amiga, Atari ST and Mega Drive. Possibly SNES, but Gods by the Bitmap Brothers, where, I got my ass kicked by it, and a particularly crap game player I knew at school completed it in the weekend. And this is, I should just be, you know, try being crap at it. And I did get, quite a bit further in it.
By just being crap.
Yeah, just by being crap, walking into, you know, enemies and stuff like that, and taking bloody ages to complete a level, it would just lower the difficulty and get rid of enemies for you. And it's just shit. But yeah, I'll take it that stuff like Resident Evil 4 does a better job.
Hmm. Well, mind you, that's like playing Captain Toad's Treasure. Was it called the Full Toil?
Was it Captain Toad's Treasure Tracker?
Yeah. Well, the sort of the re-release on Switch, and there were many times. Well, I say many times. There was perhaps three levels where it went terribly for me and Toad in episode one, and the game decided that I had suffered long enough and did offer me the option of using an invincibility mushroom, and so that I could get through the entire level in one piece, as I didn't fall off a side.
I think most people have noticed that Nintendo have actually started doing that in their titles as well, because did a similar thing happen with Yoshi?
Well, Yoshi's got you've got an option. You can like either switch between just classic mode and mellow mode, and there were some levels where again there was only a couple where I was just like, I've died too many times now for this to feel comfortable. I'm gonna just switch it down to mellow and play.
And you'll also have on several of the Mario Bros. Games, of later ones at least, where if you die too many times, then you can get the Super Raccoon kind of, P-Wing type thing that will kind of enable you to kind of just basically fly past certain obstacles and whatnot. And even, I think, some sort of switch block for Luigi to come out and take over the game or something. I can't remember exactly, but basically versions of kind of auto playing, as it were.
Yeah,
which is good, because I mean the last thing that you want is to basically get maybe two-thirds of the way through the game and there's just one part of one level that you cannot get past and just quit it after that.
It's definitely a helpful way of handling that situation. Whether or not it's the best one, I don't know. I mean, the thing is that I spend a lot of time not playing games where difficulty is such a huge part. Like Skyrim, you could have it on the hardest difficulty setting if you just don't really want to spend much time exploring the world. Like, if you want to panic every single time there's the beat of wings in the sky, sure, you can put it on its hardest difficulty. Or you could not, and you could actually enjoy it like you are the kind of Dragonborn Chosen One type thing, where stuff is perhaps a bit of an issue at times, and there are some things and creatures in the world that could deathly overwhelm you, or,
I mean, just thinking about it, the latest Smash Bros. Games, actually, on its single-player modes, they have, this kind of thing where you can choose the difficulty setting, and the more battles that you get through, you slowly increase the difficulty. And if you lose at a battle, yes, you can continue, lose half your coins or some of your coins, but then get bombed down to a different, a lower difficulty, so it kind of adapts to how well you actually progress through. Which I think is, a really good idea, to be honest, because, it allows you to steadily, kind of get a greater and greater challenge, but it doesn't penalise you to the extent where you can no longer play the game.
I think we need to offer some context as to why we're talking about this, though. Because it's due to our friendly software developers from Software and their latest release, which, can somebody who isn't me try to pronounce the title, please? Because even though we discussed how to pronounce From Software's title, I've forgotten again how to pronounce it.
I think it's Sekiro.
Sekiro?
Or Sekiro.
Is it? It's Sekiro. Sekiro Shadows Die Twice.
It's Sekiro.
Sekiro.
It's not.
Shadows Die Twice.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it would have gone without note. Like, every time From Software, I mean, you've got Demon's Souls, you've got the Dark Souls games, you've got Bloodborne, now you've got this. Them not having an adjustable difficulty is like an ongoing thing with them. It just happened that a couple of commentators this time round, and at least one in particular seemed to draw attention to the fact that there's no adjustable difficulty, and then all hell kind of broke loose online, and people have gone quite nasty over it, even
from
though...
What, you mean most of the fragile wankers?
It does feel a little bit like that.
I mean, I'm not judging the fragile, lonely, sad people, but you know who complained that you know other no, there definitely shouldn't be an easy mode because it would devalue it for some reason, even though we don't have to choose it. No, you shut up, kind of people.
It's very much kind of a sense of gatekeeping from you know people that consider themselves gamers, like hardcore gamers, that play to kind of challenge themselves, but in such a way where you know they're just kind of taking on the hardest difficulty and you know kind of getting frustrated and basically just kicking through it almost like NES game style, you know, just kind of getting through the game.
Can I just raise an eyebrow at the NES being the epitome of hard game?
Yeah, I realise that, but I remember there are several different you know YouTube celebrities or well I'm not sure whether celebrity is the right word, but YouTube people.
There are other words that could be used
that have basically been like you know out of the NES games collection, how many have you really completed? And kind of point to stuff like Battletoads and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and whatnot.
And I'll say, I didn't complete Battletoads because it's shit. And it always has been shit. And if you thought it was good back then, it's because you were shit as well. It's always been shit.
It's one of those things...
I don't like Battletoads!
It's one of those things, though, that you when you were a kid and you kind of used to have like not exactly a lot of money, you can't exactly buy it and then go, ah, well, it's too difficult. I'm not going to play it anymore.
Mm.
You will end up basically playing it over and over and over and over again. Basically, just it's more kind of pattern learning than anything else and muscle memory.
But apparently, that's how one should enjoy certain types of games like Sekiro. Apparently, getting that muscle memory and stuff.
Which I don't get, to be honest, because, you know, it's kind of not accomplishing anything apart from kind of encoding your brain to, you know, do a certain sequence of up, downs, left, rights, you know.
I mean, I'll say, you know, there's a whole hardcore gaming aspect, and it's like, oh, come on, seriously, you know, that... They should be for enjoyment, and that's not they can't be hard. Yeah. There are plenty of games. I was having this discussion on Twitter last week, and end of last week, and I gave Splinter Cell Chaos Theory as you know as one that I really enjoyed, and I played all the way through on you know the standard difficulty, and then I ramped it up to the highest, and you know. Went through and 100%ed, you know, the whole thing.
Mm.
But that's because I really enjoyed it. I really liked the mechanics of it. And I just thought, yeah, go on then. That's, you know, so it just clicked. And I got, I'll do that. Because, you know, if you've been playing a game, you know, like that, where it's got all of the, you know, mechanics and stealth mechanics and kills and gadgets and, you know, stuff like that, and all of that, by the time you get to the end of the game, you've got a really good handle on it that you otherwise wouldn't have had in the earlier levels. Mm. So yeah, that's why I did, and that's fine. But if other people wanted to just you know go through it and having you know, like one shot kills, that's not taking anything away from me, is it? I mean,
I don't
get that sort of mentality.
I think one thing that I would say is that because a lot of games obviously do this easy, medium, hard, and then legendary or, you know, whatever. Basically, they have several different difficulty settings. And what frustrates me is that you boot up the game and you get this, you know, kind of, you know, choose your difficulty. And it's like, well, I haven't played the game. I don't know how difficult it's going to be.
Though the counter for that is that you do have some games that will have that difficulty setting, but then they'll say a bit about what the experience would be like. But then you'll get other games where you can switch between difficulty settings as you play, and some that will reward you with, you know, external achievements or trophies for whether or not you switch between difficulties.
I don't know what I'd refer to myself as in terms of like gaming now, because I'm not necessarily a hardcore gamer that will play, you know, kind of Bloodborne or, you know, was it Sekiro or whatnot. I play the odd thing here or there, and, you know, when I kind of boot up a game, I'm thinking to myself, well, I don't want to miss anything, because I know that some games take content out for the easy setting.
Yeah.
But by the same token, I don't want to, you know, sit there and play the same level over and over and over and over and over again. So I won't go kind of on hard. So I'll basically just go normal by default and then kind of work from there.
Yeah, and I quite like the games where, unfortunately, none, you know, come to mind right now, but if they're, you know, if they're separated out into, you know, different story missions or, you know, whatever, you can choose the difficulty separately on each one once you've played it. And I really like that. You know, that's the kind of thing, you know, that scratches that, you know, Splinter Cell Chaos Theory itch where, yeah, now I know how to, you know, how to do this, and, you know, I've managed to, you know, do the best version of that. Then I can, you know, go back. And of course, going back to one of the, you know, the age-old favourites, GoldenEye on the N64, that had the difficulty ratings as, you know, agent, double O agent, you know, that kind of thing. And that would give you extra objectives to do depending on which difficulty.
Yeah.
And that was great. So
I think more games could use stuff to make themselves accessible to people who might have various types of impairment, or, you know, sometimes even learning difficulties. For instance, at least if you're somebody who's got dyspraxia, not only might you absolutely curse any form of mathematically based logical puzzles that might come your way, but you certainly might have some issues with timings.
Yeah,
but then
for example, the charity Special Effect, they do a lot of you know, work. So, you know, people who don't necessarily have you know, full use of, you know, fingers, hands, you know, all, you know, the whole range, they will help them play games that they otherwise might not be able to. You know, with little gadgets as a support, you know, stuff like that. And it's a really good idea. And even things like where you've got friend who was colorblind and had real difficulties playing you know, Metroid Prime on GameCube, because there were color-coded sequences. And it's just, well, that's nice. Those two are flashing, and I can't tell, you know, if they're different colours. I'm presuming they're different colours, but I've got no idea because there's no option. And I said, yeah, it's, you know, those are flashing. Those are alternating between, you know, red and green.
There was actually a Game Maker's Toolkit series. I think it's kind of still ongoing now, actually, at the moment, which is about designing games for disabilities, including stuff like, you know, kind of visual impairments and whatnot.
Yeah, it's some of it is just incredibly basic. It, you know, you don't have to redesign your game from the ground up to, you know, in order to you know, help with these, you know, issues. I mean, you just have to be aware of them in the first place.
That's the other thing, though, of like, sometimes there's so much going on screen that actually for people who've got certain other conditions, the information there might be too overwhelming.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, bullet hells, you know, are bad for that. I mean, trying to keep track of, you know, your character on the screen while there's just so much going on. Yeah, I can completely understand.
But then you've got the counter-argument from the side that's probably kind of not as, who say they're for accessibility, but they don't like difficulty settings. They'll be like, oh, but it ruins the artistic vision. And then they'll throw up stuff to do with, like, they'll start quoting stuff around, like, classic canon authors and stuff about, like, well, they never sacrificed their artistic vision, and mm-hmm. without questioning how those works became canon in the first place. And let me just say that a lot of works that get considered in the Western literary canon are not innately good works of art.
Without veering too much into certain areas, mm. I do wonder whether they are the same type of people that were to complain when a developer decides to do something that they don't like. So, say, for example, a...
yeah.
I don't even need to give an example now, because you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Well, it's always, you know, the old meme of, you know, you should, you know, the developer should do what they... you know, what they really want to do. And then it's, you know, developer does something progressive.
Yeah.
You know, no, not like that.
Absolutely.
You meant something else.
I mean, you can either turn around and say, okay, well, the developer, you know, is kind of responsible for their choices. And, you know, that's that. Or you can turn around and say that the developer needs to cater for its audience. And that's that. You can't kind of pick and choose when it kind of suits you.
And yet they think that magically, yes, you can.
But I think one thing that I would like to bring up is actually like how games kind of, well, some games actually kind of increase difficulty. So I know for some games it's like computer or like AI health is kind of increased, or they have kind
better
of,
firepower.
Yeah, better firepower, more accuracy, basically just kind of ramping up the sliders.
They seem to detect you more easily.
Or even just basically the amount of, you know, kind of enemies on screen or whatnot. And I kind of feel like that's actually quite lazy in a way. I kind of want the AI to act individually from each other. I mean, from the beginning, like Pac-Man, you know, the four ghosts are actually meant to have different slight personalities. Like one will kind of just kind of continually try and chase you down. The other one will try and get ahead of you. The other one will basically try and get you, but then run away or whatnot. And yeah.
But I mean, we're all talking about this like, games need to have only one approach to do things, and the way games could accompany for accessibility and difficulty is actually making it possible for people to to complete actions in a game in a multitude of ways.
Yeah,
and actually games like Hitman, the latest Hitman games, do a very good job of doing that, because there's not just one way to kill a mark.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. And, you know, so I think some ways can obviously be more involved or, you know, require more skill and whatnot than others.
Or, you know, in the earlier Mass Effect games, so 1 and 2, where actually you could talk your way out of things. And you just had to, I mean, you had to improve your Paragon skills and stuff to the extent where, like, that was a thing. But it actually just kept you out of some pretty hairy shooting situations when you were able to talk your way through stuff.
You know, that's kind of a good example of having different ways to play the game, and difficulty kind of needs to be, you know, kind of thinking about that as well. I mean, I'm just thinking, like, with some games, with the motivation for playing video games is different for everybody. Some people like that challenge. Some people like, you know, kind of failing 350 times and then finally getting it right, and, you know, that sense of achievement. Other people don't. They want to basically get that next cutscene to, you know, know the next episode of the story. Other people want to, you know, collect stuff. Other people basically just want to kind of go on there and shoot as many people as possible. You know, there's all sorts of different motivations for, you know, kind of people. And I think video game difficulty doesn't really, take that into account.
Yeah. And I remember, I mean, this is a bit of a niche one, but you should be used to that with me. there was a whole thing about, you know, text adventures on the 8-bits, and there are some people who objected to complicated parsers with, you know, multiple steps included in the one line. So, for example, if you wanted to pick something up in the early text adventures, because, you know, limited space, all of that kind of thing, you would have to use very specific words at very specific times. And in combinations, and that, you know, the rest of the time you say, sorry, I can't do that. Oh, I don't understand. Mm. And then, as you know, as the game has progressed, you got, you know, very complicated passes. So you could just say, get, you know, get goldfish, go to kitchen, and the same line, and rather than having to go north, north, east, open door, you know, all that kind of thing, you could just, you know. Location, and there were, oh no, no, that that takes away from the purity. It does it bollocks. It takes away from the frustration of trying, because you know exactly what you want to do in the game,
yeah,
but you can't find the word.
Absolutely,
I mean, the computer knows.
In the end, if you're having a game that basically requires you to go through mundane steps that you and the computer know that you can do, it's say for example backtracking. You know, in video games, that can obviously be very, very tedious. Obviously, they can liven it up by, you know, including power-up items or areas that you couldn't get to before, or shortcuts and whatnot. But by the same token, you know, going through the same locations again and again and again is not fun if there's nothing new for you to do or new for you to discover. It's basically just an extra step to pad out the game.
Exactly, it's just padding, and it's frustrating, and you know, that kind of thing. You very quickly get bored of it.
There's definitely been games where I've stopped playing because the difficulty or how it's decided to present playing has gotten to the extent where I'm just like, I can't be bothered now. Tekken 5 is probably the biggest one, because we went from having Tekken 4 and 3, which had difficulty settings, and then Tekken 5, you didn't have that option, if I remember correctly. Or am I mistaken? This was Soul Calibur 3.
I can't remember.
Soul Calibur 2 was, like, friendlier, and then Soul Calibur 3 was like, oh, you've had things too easy in Soul Calibur 2. We're going to mess with you. And it just kind of, like, you know, you went from being able to maybe manage things if you weren't a combo genius to being like, what's the point? This is only made for a very minuscule number of people. And that's the thing. Like, there's also a commercial need in a way, actually, for some, like, game development, where you can spend a lot of money and then even less so than film or TV, not be able to make it back. Even if it initially flops on release, you know, and with games, if they're not something that you can adapt to easily as a player, you never, you know, people aren't necessarily going to buy it and play it, or they might start bad mouthing it. And there's that commercial need to be like, well, people need to enjoy it. Like people have tried to bring up again, like canon literature. It's like, oh, you know, no sacrifice, artistic vision, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, those weren't commercial works. Those were literary works quite often that were published. The only time something might have been... even Dickens wasn't visionary. He was a populist. You know, he wrote what people wanted.
Most of his stories were published in installments, in magazines. Yeah. So...
it's a little easier to handle.
Episodic content.
Yes. But then something like Proust. Proust's writing was never... because I'm pretty sure I saw somebody bring up Proust in one of these arguments. It's like, Proust's writing was never meant to be for commercial markets. Whereas pretty much the major... except for some video games, and then the indie games where they might have an artistic vision, actually quite often correlate to being accessible from a playing perspective anyway. Most commercial games, like, they can't be too difficult, because you've got to get that balance between it costs a lot of money to develop a game, you've got a limited market to sell to, the people with money also happen to be people who spend a lot of time in work, they have limited time, there's low effort entertainment you're also competing against, more so today than ever before, like trying to get that balance between time availability, playability, and it's a tough balance to get.
Yeah, from a commercial perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can have a tortured artist, sitting in their, their tiny little room.
In their garret.
Yeah, just, painting away or writing away, and, the whole, oh, yes, but, such and such an artist was, is amazing, and look how much his, paintings go for. Yeah, that's nice. He died penniless.
Hmm.
So... that work was never commercial.
And I think
it's all very well, invoking these things, but it's irrelevant. These things have to turn a profit, and I think if all these wankers want the bragging right to be able to say that I completed Sekiro or the latest From Software game or anything like that, where it can be a badge of honor to the people who know. All you need is an achievement which says never played on easy or, whatever.
Yeah.
And there you go. If they want to be, such about it, then make sure that you lose a trophy if you ever even, go down the menu to have a look at the difficulty. And then, they should be happy with that, because then if it's on their profile, then they've got the bragging rights and they can shut up.
Can I just say that? I feel like Nintendo games are interesting in this regard, because they're kind of obviously designed for people to get through. But I feel like the skill that you can actually have in those actually extends beyond the main game itself. So you get, say, for example, Super Metroid, where you can get through the entire game, basically kind of powering up, leveling up, doing what you're meant to do and get out of there. That's all fine. But then there's advanced stuff like was it the morph ball bombing, where you can actually climb using the morph balls bombs.
Yeah. Yeah.
In order to get to places before kind of meant to, and stuff like that. So I feel like there is kind of the system is not so tight as to kind of prevent people from doing things that they aren't otherwise meant to. Whereas games like Dark Souls, because it's so reliant upon, from what I've heard anyway, it's so reliant upon basically making sure that you know the patterns of the enemies and when you can attack, and doing that over and over and over and over again. That sounds to me like there's very, very little that you can kind of do to master the game more than, you...
Mind you, another thing with, like, the Dark Souls games, I don't know if it was the case with Bloodborne, but something does Dark Souls, like, you could get other people in to a degree to help you take on certain challenges, and Sekiro, there's not that. You're by yourself. You have no backup. But there are other ways, as from what I've seen, that it makes things palatable, or that it's not going to completely take you down forever. Like how you respawn and stuff is not too terrible, but it's just not my kind of game. The closest I get to that kind of game, and not that I've played Devil May Cry 5, but I am replaying Bayonetta on Switch at the moment, and that's quite a learn the patterns, jump around like a maniac, see the signs, dodge, then going for a hit kind of game. And I'm playing it on normal. I could have played it on very easy or easy, where this particular ability that makes it a little easier to fight is easier to do in some ways, but actually it's not the easiest, because there's this thing called witch time, where time slows down. If you dodge at just the last moment from an enemy attack, but actually it's easier to enter that mode in the harder difficulties. It's got a bit of a resi for difficulty
situation.
Is that situation.
Because there's like a larger window for what yeah. you can do with that? Or is it more to do with the amount of attacks?
It's the amount of attacks keep coming at you, so you're more likely to just keep going...
Oh, yeah, I suppose if you've got like five guys trying to attack you and on easy mode, one of them does it at a time, and then on the harder mode, you get like four at them at a time. Yeah, yeah, it's more likely to be able to hit in the... In the golden
Admittedly, they obviously the harder difficulties in Bayonetta, the when you get hit, the more it takes off your health.
So yeah, basically.
You kind of basically. You just get to a situation where you just like don't want to get hit, boom, 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 boom.
But I still want my kind of AIs to be individualistic. I mean, I really liked Perfect Dark's multiplayer mode where you can actually change the. When you kind of got a team of Sims and whatnot, you can change the behavior of the Sims. Mm. I found that to be really, really quite interesting.
I suppose in a way it's whether or not in terms of the way the really scripted interactive events happen as to whether or not you can make moments of that adjustable. And there are some games that obviously there's a lot you can adjust outside of even just the basic control settings. Like obviously accessibility can be improved when you have things like you can custom map buttons and stuff. Or obviously you make sure that basically the way controller setups work that you could use it with non-traditional controller settings. So if somebody needs to play one-handed or they're playing with their feet, their mouth, the sides of their head potentially in some games, like anything where basically you haven't got two hands to play with. If you've got control customizability, that's important for accessibility. There's other stuff like we talked about with like the colors, like not relying on colors for things, because I can see,
or at least having like color
alternative
I think some games do that where you can go into the settings and kind of colorblind settings where you can kind of change stuff like that.
Obviously some like a games publisher like Ubisoft seems to spend a lot of time thinking about accessibility in comparison to some companies, but I mean, going around, and I think as we've kind of been sort of suggesting, it seems to all boil down to this quite masculine idea of achievement, where you need to have done something really difficult in order to have achieved anything at all.
Yeah, the whole bragging rights thing, and blah blah blah.
But if I, aside from trying to have some kind of very customizable settings for a game that affects things like AI some various types of rates for certain aspects of the game, I think the main thing I'd like to see is just games offer you more than one way to complete a task.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I did have a game in mind for that. Oh, yes. Breath of the Wild. That's a very good one for basically, you have a certain amount of tools and you can take an approach to defeating a camp in many, many different ways. You can kind of fly over a head and, try and bomb them first, or you can kind of go stealthy, try and shoot them, or any number of ways, including using Magnesis Rune to, thwack them with stuff.
I like games when you get that kind of just
the moment of I didn't realise you could do that.
I think, guys, I'm going to need to move us on to what we've been up to. I think what are we saying though? Are we saying that
I'd like to say that difficulty isn't as simple as people think it is. And that in general people play for different reasons, and you shouldn't really look down on somebody because they're gonna choose like a lower difficulty setting or whatnot because they actually want to get through the game rather than spending 500 hours trying to master the skill enough to get perfect timing.
Not everyone's got the time, and not everyone's got the patience, and not everyone can have the same skill, but that shouldn't stop them from enjoying the same game,
especially considering I was told that on average it takes about 30 to 40 hours of lessons to pass your driving test roughly. think about how many hours people spend in like Final Fantasy or, you know, Skyrim or, you know, any number of different games, mastering things and leveling up, but you're not really affecting your wider life that much in comparison.
Yeah.
Okay. What have people been up to? Retroid?
Well, one of the things I've been up to is I jumped at the chance to get the latest Humble Monthly early because it was Assassin's Creed Origins. Yes. And it's quite good. I am enjoying it, and Egypt is nice, and it is pretty. And most of the time, I've not been doing missions. I've just been running through these various locations, getting the vantage points, you know, synchronizing with my eagle. And, yeah, just really enjoying it and thinking, wow, the Library of Alexandria and, you know, these pyramids with their original white coverings, all, you know, all that kind of thing. So, you know, also just appreciating that they picked a moment in Egypt's history where it's I think it's called the Hellenistic period. It's pretty much where, you know, the Greeks have taken over. So you've got Alexandria, which is, you know, it's far more Greek than it is Egyptian. And, you know, some of the clash of cultures and all of that. I'm kind of nerding out and really enjoying the sights in it, which of course is part, you know, it's part and parcel. It's part of the reason it's there. But yeah, I've been enjoying that.
Reminds me slightly when Assassin's Creed first came out, and looking at some of the footage of, you know, sort of like, you know, you kind of passing people in a crowd and kind of shooing them out the way or kind of climbing up, you know, kind of. Buildings and whatnot, and then yeah, I'm just kind of reminded like these were meant to be like technical marvels, and it's like in terms of kind of animation, they're you know fantastic, you know, little kind of bits, but do they really add anything to gameplay necessarily?
Well, those bits did, because then you could hide it in plain sight so long as you could find, you know, a group, but yeah, the AI was never that great in them. See, you could just walk over and snicked. And then just walk off with a bunch of monks, and the guards would be going, I don't know. It's definitely not that blood-soaked bloke in white who's walking along with the other people who don't look anything like him.
It always astounds me, because obviously you have, like, enemies. Like, it reminds me of when Emily was playing Captain Toad. Yesterday, which I know you'll get to, but there was kind of a bit where you were basically hiding from a shy guy who was like on patrol, because you know, as soon as they spot you, they kind of go after you, and you were basically just ever so slightly out of eye line enough for it to be, you know, like, oh, it won't notice you, but so much so that it was like, how can you not see that toad there? How can you? And then you kind of have to remind yourself, it is a video game, and these are, you know, pre-programmed scripted characters. That's how it works, kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, bless. I know you have to game the whole thing, but yeah, you know. But yeah, I really liked the original Assassin's Creed, because you know, seeing some of these places like Acre and Damascus. Just, you know, beautiful cities. And of course, you know that they're not entirely faithful and they're compressed and et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't matter, because they're nice, and it's not an environment that you get to play in a lot.
What would you say that Assassin's Creed is kind of historical enough to actually teach people a little bit about history of, like, a particular time in a particular place? Or is it just, like, borrowing aesthetics and that's it?
Well, seeing as you mentioned that, the latest Assassin's Creed game does have a mode which was I think it was added after release. Obviously, I've got it now because I've got it long after release. But where you get tours, narrated tours, where you could, you know, go inside one of the Great Pyramids and it would say, you know, this chamber was, you know, discovered and such and such. You know, the way it's constructed and, you know, the changes they made in the game to make it more accessible, like, you know, we widened this passage because it's barely big enough to, for, you know, a very small, slight frame person to get through. But, we've made it so that you can just crouch.
I can imagine if they did that as a VR experience, that would be good.
Oh, it would be nice. I mean, the only difficulty there is, of course, Assassin's Creed is third person.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I would love to have a look around a lot of these environments in VR. It's one of the few things that... Well, I've said for years that a lot of these times when they're creating these environments, can you not just... You know, Alien Isolation is another example. Obviously, it's not historical in the true sense, apart from, you know, in style of sci-fi cinema. But just to be able to walk around those environments with no threat, just so you can, you know, really enjoy all the care and craft that's gone into creating them.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of...
I'm talking myself into playing Alien Isolation again.
But no, it kind of reminds me of when I first heard about, was that Star Trek VR game?
Yeah.
And then there was like a mod for like the Enterprise and whatnot. And that kind of, I don't know about the game itself, but that would be kind of cool, just kind of sticking on the headset, looking around and kind of being on the bridge of the Enterprise.
I watched a few videos where it's just, you know, obviously 2D.
Yeah.
You know, people walking around in the environment and just thinking, yeah, this looks pretty cool. I would have killed for this. You know, like 1992. Yep, it's just, who do you want dead? so I can just walk around in this environment with, you know, in this fidelity. But yeah, it's just, well, it's cool that those exist, but is anyone going to do anything with them? And it, a lot of the time, it's because I'm such a nerd with things like Next Generation. I was spotting one or two things that they'd got wrong.
Oh, okay.
Thinking, you know, so just some of the proportions. So that if you stood on certain parts of the bridge, it looked a little bit wrong. And it's just, that would bother the hell out of me.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I've... playing Assassin's Creed and managed to configure it so that it streams, because of course it's a Uplay game. Oh no, a separate game launch on my PC. However will I cope? But of course the, you know, the Steam links work by pretending to be a Steam controller. So if I was in my shed or in another room of the house and I was using a Steam Link and I would load up Assassin's Creed or, you know, Oranges, then it would be mouse and keyboard control. It wouldn't see that there was a controller.
Okay.
But fortunately, the way around that is to create a non-Steam game link within Steam, launch it from there, it then loads it up with a Steam overlay, which you can bring up with the, you know, the Xbox home button, basically. Okay. Or equivalent, other controllers are available. And then you can say, yes, pretend to be a, you know, an Xbox 360 or an Xbox One pod. And then it worked pretty flawlessly after that. So, yeah, that's cool.
Nice.
Let's see, TV things.
Ooh, yeah.
I have been watching Doom Patrol.
Is that with the help of Dave Internet, though?
Dave Internet has been very helpful because no one has picked it up. It's not been picked up for streaming. It's not been picked up by any of the TV channels in the UK.
I have to admit, I'm a little bit perturbed because when I was a kid, everything seemed to go on, you know, Sky first. That, you know, as soon as it was produced, it was almost like on Sky. And then you have to wait ages for it to actually kind of come onto regular TV. Now that we've got Now TV and the amount of times that we've got stuff that's coming out, like, you know, we've had to wait ages for The Rookie or for The Orville and stuff like that. And it's kind of really frustrating because it's like, part of the reason why we wanted this is so that we can get it pretty much as soon as the Americans, you know, it's like showing its home territory.
But but something like Doom Patrol, from the screenshots I've seen, because Mark Sheppard's been quite liberally sharing it on account of the fact that he's in the show, right? As a particular
character. Yeah, he's in about two episodes.
Yeah. But the thing is that Doom Patrol's made as part of DC's online TV offering, correct? For their own subscription service.
I think so.
Which is only available in the US currently.
Yeah, but then so is Star Trek Discovery.
Yes. So it's kind of like we've had like not a reverse thing, because obviously, but mind you, see, at least CBS had the sense to kind of release stuff at the same time as Netflix for the rest of the world, so that people weren't trying to legally use CBS outside of the US. And I just feel like gating releases so that it encourages potential audiences towards piracy is not a good idea.
It's just, once again, I saw an excellent little meme. It was from SpongeBob. And it was just, you know, how many times do we have to tell you this, old man? And it's, you know, the audience, as once again, all these big companies think, hey, we can do our own streaming service and just splinter the market some more again.
You know what gets me, though, is the amount of people that have gone, turned around to me and said, oh, yeah, you know, on, you know, the either the Fire Stick or, you know, on a tablet or whatnot, there's an app that you can download where you can get absolutely everything for free. And it's like, you're talking about piracy.
Yeah.
You kind of, I mean, I get why you'd want to do that. But in essence, it's piracy. And in essence, it's obviously a flawed system because you're kind of downloading something that's dodgy as fuck. That can be shut down at any time and
be poisoned in some way.
Yeah, it is contributing to, you know, basically TV series not getting as much funding as it should do and stuff like that. And I get why you do it, but by the same token, it's...
Meanwhile, is Doom Patrol any good?
Yeah.
Yes, I frankly did not think it would be. Because it's based on the hello, I've got my cat here. She's decided to come in and have a chat.
Hello,
hey, Callie. There we go. Because it particularly odd. I think it was early 90s. Yes, hello, Callie. Comic series, which was relaunched. I think the original Doom Patrol was like a 60s odd superhero.
Hmm.
Series, but you know, this was relaunched as a bit of a more weird.
So kind of, I mean, does Doom Patrol at any point then circle towards Justice League Dark or Constantine or Hellblazer?
It's far more Vertigo.
Okay.
I mean, let's see. I'll read out some of the characters. There's Crazy Jane, a member of the Doom Patrol with 64 distinct personalities, each displaying a different superpower. Rita Farr, a member of the Doom Patrol and a former actress who developed the power to stretch, shrink, and grow after being exposed to toxic liquid. It's more complicated than that because she has difficulty keeping her form.
Mm.
Because she was like a 1950s... Well, not earlier than that. I think it was like 1930s, 40s. Movie actress and, doing, various romance action, things. And, I think she accidentally is either killed or consumed or absorbed by a swamp creature or some kind. Yeah. it's a thing which basically makes her turn into a blob and she melts. And she cannot control it. So far, so, you know, two female characters, they are quite interesting. Jane is played by Diane Guerrero from Orange is the New Black.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah. She's good to watch. Then you've got, let's see, Cliff, played, or at least voiced by, Brendan Fraser.
Mm. Oh, wow.
He's an arsehole.
But Brendan Fraser or?
Well, from what I can tell, Brendan Fraser is really nice. So,
yeah.
But
he's always seemed quite nice to me, but yeah.
Yeah, it seems like he gets a kick out of Cliff because, a member of the Doom Patrol, former NASCAR driver, whose brain is transplanted into a robot body after an accident destroying his own.
As you do.
As a person, Cliff was a complete arsehole. As you can see in the pilot episode, because he's basically shagging the babysitter, and his wife's cheating on him because he's an asshole, and then it all goes to hell. And you know, part of his issue is that with him being in a robot body, he cannot feel anything. He's got no sensation whatsoever, and he thinks he was the only one to survive, but it turns out that no, he wasn't. Then you've got Alan Tudyk as Mr. Nobody. Say, a living shadow able to drain the sanity of others while being after being experimented on by ex-Nazis in post-war Paraguay. He also plays the narrator. He's basically, because he's so he's pan-dimensional, he's broken apart.
Okay.
He is literally fragmentary. When he's shown in the series, he narrates to the audience, and he's a really good character. And then you've got Larry Traynor / Negative Man, a member of the Doom Patrol and former pilot who crashed into negative energy and is now wrapped in bandages from head to toe. And he is effectively either dead or immortal, depending on how, you know, you look at it, and he cannot communicate with the energy being that reanimates him.
Mm.
And you've got the chief, or, you know, basically the Professor X, which is Dr. Niles Corder, played by Timothy Dalton.
Ooh.
So it's got a cast, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It does, yeah.
Between, say, Brendan Fraser, who, you know, he doesn't play the character in the suit, but he you know, he does the voice and he appears in the occasional flashback. Let's see. I'll try and you know, squeeze it down. Yeah, I wasn't too sure with the, you know, the pilot, but then you always have to kind of allow that with pilots, because it's very rare that a pilot will land and it will be exactly as the series is.
No, I mean, there have been a couple of pilots where I've just been like, what was it, the Teen Titans one was just like,
Yeah, there are some pilots that actually put me off the series. Then, you know, I've gone back later, and I've got a later episode, and I've got, okay, this is bloody brilliant. How, you know, and then I sort of work back.
Ah, okay.
And then it's like, yeah, the pilot was...
So you start in the middle, that's the secret.
Was a bit crap, yeah. Well, it can be, but... let's see. One of the most recent... Well, there are a few recent episodes. One, which was my favourite because I remembered it from the comic, which is called Danny the Street.
Danny the Street.
Danny the Street. It's a self-aware street who's gay.
Okay.
And it travels, so it can appear in a different place. It can appear in the middle of a field, or it can appear as a previously unnoticed, you know, alley or side street in a big city. But it won't stay there for long. It's the idea is Danny wants to help people who get a shit deal. So seeing as Danny is gay, for, you know, for want of a better term for a supernatural street, it can travel around the world, and anyone who, you know, is different, identifies as different, feels as different, and can't be who they are in those particular places, is attracted to Danny and then can live on the street.
Is this still part of Doom Patrol?
This is Doom Patrol.
Oh, okay.
This is an example of its own thing. This is an example of this is one episode of Doom Patrol.
Okay.
And just an example of how, you know, weird it can be. So of course, Danny is hiding from you know, various government agencies who frown on non-normality, which, you know, it does mean exactly what it sounds like, and also because he's moving around, he is a street.
Hmm.
Also, of course, Danny LaRue. Yeah. So Danny the street. And the Doom Patrol go there, and they're, you know, they're communicating with Danny, who communicates with street signs, and, you know, everything that, and also just smoke writing in the sky, you know, things like that. So, you know, Danny will talk to guests, and this is an episode of that I'm never going to see in any other series. But it was just brilliant. And then there was a two-parter, which is the one Mark Shepherd.
Yep.
Is it? Yeah. Was in. Where there's the chosen one has been born.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's very bad, and the cult that's been raising him wants to use him to bring forth the Uncreator.
So basically some form of apocalypse.
Yeah. Except it's a weirder form of the apocalypse.
Okay.
Because it consists of the Uncreator is a giant eye in the sky that everyone can see, and it's just constantly looking around, and if it looks directly at you, then it will uncreate you.
Ooh.
So okay. Obviously it has no peripheral vision.
No. That's another good two-parter where it's just, yeah, this is really weird. And that was the point of the series where I thought, this feels like watching the comic. It's just strange and weird, and it's a very good series. And I really hope it gets picked up, because I'm annoyed that, you know, me and my wife and Dave Internet can watch it easily enough, but anyone else who actually wants to contribute money, say, like, I would like to contribute money, please be on one of these channels that I can subscribe to. Please. And then I will be perfectly happy with some of my money going towards things like Doom Patrol, because I want a second season.
I mean,
but at the moment, I can't do anything with it.
Quite frankly, I feel like Netflix should be picking up as much stuff as they can, considering they're going to be losing a whole load of Marvel and just general Disney stuff.
Yeah, I would really like Netflix to, you know, come along and just, you know, please, you know, pick things like this up, because I want to be able to watch them legally. That was the whole attraction of Netflix and Amazon Prime, even though Amazon Prime in the UK seems to be a pale imitation of what people talk in the US. So, you know, when we've been subscribed to it for one reason or another, like if we really want Prime delivery, and of course everything's thrown in because they want you to, you know, subscribe. So we'll have a month of Amazon Prime, and it's a real struggle. Not only was the interface awful last time I used it, but just trying to find content that we actually wanted to watch.
Yeah, for us, it's always been rather slow.
Yeah. But, I will sum up my not very good description of Doom Patrol with just There's a few characters which are only in, you know, one or two episodes. So he is a few. There's a guest star of Curtis Armstrong as the voice of Ezekiel the Cockroach, a talking doomsday prophet cockroach.
Okay.
I mean, a doomsday prophet cockroach. Chantel Barry as the voice of Baphomet, an oracle in the form of a female horse.
SD.
Yeah. And of course, Mark Shepherd as Willoughby Kipling, an occult detective, chaos magician, and member of the Knights Templar, who, like I said, is pretty shit-faced in the episode. Because I think he pretty much says, in order to do, you know, stuff like this, you've got to be a bit drunk.
Fair.
And yeah, I would just really like it to be picked up by something, because I want more episodes. And I think there's only going to be about 10 episodes looking at this page.
And I'll take it it's not been renewed or anything yet.
I've heard nothing about... I've heard Sod All. So... I'll just say, you know, as part of a, you know, a little thing, one of the things which happens in the, you know, the pilot two-parter is an entire town is abducted, as in the town is abducted, and kept in a pocket universe up a donkey's backside.
Up a donkey's backside?
Yes.
This sounds like a cross between Supernatural and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
It is. That's not an unfair description, because the bloke who was writing most of this run, that, you know, that the series is based on, is Scottish. So it's definitely... It's a Brit doing a weird take on Americana.
Fair.
It is good. Of course, I would say, you know, read the original comics, but probably cost a fortune in collections now. But yeah, if you get a chance, or if this comes out on in a DVD or Blu-ray, I think it's worth it. It is definitely worth it.
Okay. Emily?
Oh, gosh.
I know.
Okay, so we ended up... No, it wasn't last week. It's the week before last, where we had kind of like a double... two nights in a row going to the cinema.
Oh, yes.
So, one Thursday night, we went and saw Pet Sematary, the new film based on Stephen King's novel of the same name. The novel which I had tried studiously reading in recent weeks. The film turned out to be, in some ways, a pale imitation of the novel. I haven't seen the film that was made far closer to the novel's original release, but this version was certainly... It kind of missed a lot of the points that the novel had been trying to make about family and death and, you know, kind of being careful what you wish for, and also kind of they switched some character roles around quite majorly, which was quite frustrating.
I mean, it must have been quite bad for you, because obviously you'd been so excited about the film, you know, so eager to watch it, that you're kind of worried that our cinema wouldn't pick it up.
Yeah.
But it did, and went to watch it opening night.
Yeah.
And just disappointed.
I mean, it wasn't the worst horror film I've seen. It's just, if you're going to do something with a property like Pet Sematary, there are ways you could go about it which are not that film. Like, for instance, there's this phrase that gets repeated a lot in the novel. It's something like Oz the Great and Terrible, or something like that, which is from, obviously, the Wizard of Oz novels. But it gets repeated in the film repeatedly without any context. And the context in the novel is that it is the mother's... deceased sister's thing. She used to like reading the Wizard of Oz or whatever, and had Wizard of Oz posters in her room in the novel, and would say that phrase, and the wife would talk to the main male protagonist about this and stuff at a certain point, and so he would end up thinking about Oz the Great and Terrible repeatedly. But it just got repeated repeatedly in the film with none of this context. It was like, why are they...
To be honest, I didn't even notice it.
Yeah, it got said a couple of times. There's like an affectionate thing between, like, is it Lewis? What's the name of the dad again?
Oh, I can't remember.
Yeah, sorry, I can't remember character names, but between him and his daughter, repeatedly. But without any of that context, it's like, sort of took that without any reason. There were characters they didn't use. There were characters which had no redeeming features and stuff that they did have in the novel. And I was just like, why bother? It's certainly not... I mean, I haven't seen the It remake or, you know, reimagining. But considering the amount of praise that had heaped on it, there, this is not...
I remember seeing the poster and seeing like the kids in like you know, kind of creepy animal masks.
Yeah.
And they kind of appear during the film once.
Right near the beginning.
Right near the beginning. And never really properly referenced again.
Yeah.
Which kind of threw me as kind of, so you basically kind of took that as kind of a visual motif for selling the film, but didn't do anything with it.
Yeah.
Do you reckon a lot of these issues would be addressed with a longer cut?
No.
Because I know, you know, yeah. It's just sometimes, if, you know, if things are left hanging and then an extended version comes out.
They actively made a lot of changes to it, which were just like, what? Or unemphasized things that were important in the novel that actually you should have emphasized, which was just frustrating.
It's just why.
Yeah. So I wouldn't say it's the best Stephen King novel adaptation out there. It's creepy. It's not scary. There's other films I spend my time watching. Certainly of Stephen King films. The next thing we went and saw was we saw Shazam. The following night, complete opposite direction. Because we haven't seen Aquaman, so it's the first DC movie we'd seen since Justice League.
Yes, because Wonder Woman was before Justice League, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it's the first DC film we've seen since Justice League. It was pleasant.
It was pleasant. Quite like
it was. It was pleasant.
It was pleasant. It was a romp.
Oh dear.
But I mean, we're in the age of, you know, so many superhero films now that you kind of have to make a real special effort for it to stand out. And it had its moments, and it was a very, very different tone to the DC universe than would seem.
That we've definitely seen so far.
So it felt like it tried to link itself to the DC extended universe. But it kind of didn't feel like it at the same time.
There was also some other stuff with the film that I was like, like its logic was a bit flawed for some parts. It was to do with like bad guys and things. It was just a bit
true.
He's not my favourite Captain Marvel. and in fact, I did make a point of wearing the Nine Inch Nails t-shirt that Captain Marvel wears in Captain Marvel to the Shazam screening that we went to, just because I could.
Because you could.
Because I could.
The best reason.
Yeah. But other stuff I've been up to, I actually go back to Stephen King. I finished finally reading The Shining for the first time all the way through.
Ooh.
I do actually have Dr. Sleep waiting for me to read. Which, speaking of cats, has a cat on it, on the front cover.
Cats, you say?
Yeah, cats. What card? Yes. And it was... I think I prefer the novel to the film. I think the film kind of... Like, okay, Stanley Kubrick, blah, 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 auteur. You know, Jack Nicholson, blah, fine. People get really caught up in those aspects, but actually the novel, A, explains what The Shining is, which is basically psychic powers, sort of psychokinesis, telepathy, clairvoyancy, blah, 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 like a lot better, builds up way more effectively, and explains far better why everything is happening. And basically the hotel in of itself has turned into almost an eldritch horror. It is so much terrible shit has happened there that it's gained a power of its own. And that's way more clear in the novel than the film.
I always thought it was kind of inferred in the film.
Yeah, kind of inferred, but the novel does a better job of bring it out, and also bring out that the hotel is dangerous. That in the novel, like the hotel in of itself is a danger to its occupants, not just Jack Nicholson running around with an axe.
I do recall that several years ago, Stephen King, who I already knew was unhappy,
yeah,
with the Kubrick, you know, adaptation, did a far more faithful TV mini series, you know, adaptation.
Yeah.
And of course, people didn't like that anywhere near as much.
But if they hadn't had the Kubrick stuff beforehand and the weird aura that had built up, they probably would have felt completely differently. So I finished reading The Shining. I actually completed the main story of Yoshi's Crafted World. It's the first video game that I like completed the main part of without obsessing over collectibles for quite a while. So I played that on Switch. Not my usual type of game, but the fact that you had a alterable difficulty that you could alter at any time was quite endearing for me. I played most of the game. I probably played 90% of the game on classic mode, which is Yoshi just jumps and stuff, gets hurt by a certain amount, versus mellow mode, where he has a set of wings, or the Yoshi has a set of wings, the Yoshi doesn't get hurt as badly when enemies hurt it and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was actually quite satisfying, regardless, like getting through the levels and stuff and figuring out how to do things. Though I did get like it was perhaps a little too it came forward a little too soon about why didn't you switch down to mellow mode after I died for like the fourth time. I was like, look, I can die for another six more times before I will consider switching to mellow mode, thank you.
Yeah, screw you, you're not my dad.
Yeah. But at least it was optional difficulty with added mechanics. So had that. And then I played through episode one of Captain Toad's Treasure Tracker, where there were a couple of points where I did take the kind of invincibility like mushrooms and just kind of blitz through levels. But then I would go back and try to complete the extra tasks. Because you'd like there'd be like different conditions on each chapter or level or whatever, where it's like, well, if you collect this, or if you manage to do this, or you manage to not do that, like you get like an extra completion point. I have noticed though that since I completed episode one, it was like, oh, now we've got these best time options, so complete within this amount of time. And like, I'm not sure if I can bring myself to quite do that. There's like a level of mastery there that's kind of not my style of playing.
Yeah, it's just.
But I will probably start playing episode two, which features Toadette as the main character in the future. But then I've also started replaying. I mean, it's a replay, but I haven't played this game since 2011, 2010? I think 2011. Bayonetta. I've been playing that on the Switch. Obviously, a game where you're kind of hammering at the controls quite a bit to try and get combos and keep away from enemies and stuff. It's quite interesting to play on something like the Switch with the controls. I'm not sure if I quite like it yet. I'm kind of getting by. I did restart redo some levels this evening because I was like, I wanted to do better. It's been so long since I played and I'm playing on normal. And I know I could get better scores because you get rated from like, oh god, was it stone, which is like the worst rating, and then there's like bronze, silver, gold, platinum in terms of how you get ranked for completing a level versus like time, how much damage you take, what your combo situation is like. Keep in mind, I got paid to write a game guide for this game.
So, like, well, many years ago now, isn't it?
Well, obviously, it's like it was the year before we started this podcast. And I can hardly remember anything.
Maybe you should go back to your game guide and get some tips.
Well, you see, the site that hosted it no longer exists. It might be saved on a computer hard drive of mine somewhere, maybe. But the thing is that since then, like, loads of people have written guides and made a million more videos and stuff.
True, but I mean, are you going to trust those strangers? Are you going to trust
Past Emily? But yeah, it's fun playing it. I know that it gets quite difficult later on, but I'm kind of allowing myself to replay chapters if I want to do better, or if I want to get more Halo so I can buy more stuff. So that's that.
Fair shout.
Yeah. And that's everything I've been up to, pretty much. Paul.
Me? Okay, that's you. What I've been doing. I've been writing stuff. So yeah, working on a TV series. Doubt if it's anything's ever going to happen to it, but you know, if I don't write it, then it definitely won't get made. But it's kind of a fun project for me at the moment, so I'm kind of, you know, quite into that currently. I've also been going a lot on YouTube, and there's this game that intrigues me on well, not on YouTube itself, but videos of it. And that is, what is it? Skylines. Cityscapes or something like that.
Oh, that, yeah.
And that's kind of intrigued me, because I've kind of seen videos of people fixing kind of roads and stuff. So basically, the game is a bit like Sim City in the sense that, you know, you're there, you build a city, build the roads going to everything, build you know, the houses, you build, you know, the industry.
Not that he's ever played Sim City.
No, that's true. you build mass transport systems, build roundabouts, or, you know, this type of thing. Just like, you can kind of get a sense of how well the city's doing by stuff like the traffic in the city, and whether it kind of gets bunched up in different places, or, you know, just kind of whether the city works correctly. And it's kind of interesting to kind of see stuff being fixed in that respect. Instead of having like a, you know, one-way junction here, if, you know, you have a bypass that will go to this part of the town or whatnot, and you know, kind of having to like have like services like the fire department or schools or whatnot in certain kind of parts and whatnot, and as soon as the city grows, you know, too big, you kind of have to add in more stuff, and, you know, kind of build up and up and up, and yeah, it's kind of just interesting. I mean, there's no kind of natural disasters that happen or anything like that. Godzilla doesn't rampage through your city or anything like that. But it's just kind of seems more intriguing. And I've never really been intrigued by simulators before, other than maybe like Roller Coaster Tycoon, which I'm not sure whether it's technically a simulator per se.
I would say it is.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just say something that's been bothering me? I think I said dyspraxia earlier for something to do with like logic and numbers and stuff, and I meant dyscalculia. I meant dyspraxia for the trying to move your limbs enough to be able to play a game, or your digits enough.
Yeah.
But I meant dyscalculia for logic number puzzles.
Ah, right.
Just wanted to say that. But anyway, okay. Sorry.
That was way, way back.
I know, but it suddenly popped into my head. I just sort of heard the words go from her head, and I was like, no, wait.
You're imagining the Twitter responses going, what are you talking about? That isn't dyspraxia.
So, yeah, sorry.
That's right. Let's see, what else have I been doing? I've been watching, like, say, for example, videos detailing about the new Mortal Kombat that's coming out. All like the characters and
we do like whatnot. A bit of Mortal Kombat in this household.
And it is coming to Switch and
Toasty.
I will be buying it on Switch at some point. I'm not entirely sure that I'm gonna have enough, you know, cash when it first Well, saying that, I think it's around payday that it launches. So I might be able to.
But either way, you'll be picking up.
Yeah, yeah. And there has been a bit of controversy surrounding it in the sense that all of the gameplay footage that's been released so far has been of the other versions, and there's been no kind of Switch version kind of gameplay. So reportedly, from people that have seen it behind closed doors, it's looking very, very pretty. But it's just not been, you know, kind of put out into, like, the wider world. So
I feel like Mortal Kombat doesn't need, like, stupendous, like, graphics. Like, there's only... I mean, considering that they've thankfully made the outfits of certain female characters a bit less risque over the years, it's like you don't need super amazing graphics for, like, crotch lines these days.
beg pardon?
Well, consider Mortal Kombat female character outfits over the years have not left much to the imagination.
Yeah.
Really?
And I saw the sort of probably the same bunch who were complaining about game difficulty, complaining about the that they're more covered up.
Mm. I mean, we've seen videos in the past about... in tournaments and whatnot, kind of utilizing scantily clad women as kind of a tactic for distracting your opponent and stuff like that. But yeah, that's just like it's kind of a bit of a weird meta game type thing. But yeah, anyway, where was I?
Mortal Kombat.
Okay, so yeah, kind of looking
Mortal Kombat. Sorry.
Earlier on, I actually watched a video of like 50 funny quips from like the previous Mortal Kombat game, which kind of interesting because when you start a match, you know, one of the characters kind of says something, the other character, the opponent, you know, kind of has some sort of, you know, kind of bantery type thing, and then there's a witty kind of end to it and whatnot. So yeah, some of those can actually be quite interesting. So I think, what was it, Bo Ray Cho in one was like, oh, you're my Liu Kang, you're my favourite student. Ah, I bet you say that to Kung Lao as well. Yeah, but in his case, I'm actually, you know, telling the truth.
Is there anything else you've been up to? We've made it onto, we finished season 7 of The House.
That is true, yes. Just before recording tonight, we've finished watching season 7 of House. We are slowly getting through there.
But season 8...
Season 8, well, I mean, because didn't you say that you wanted us to catch up on Game of Thrones before?
Yeah, but we have to watch the whole of season 7. This is not just a, oh, let's watch everything that came out this week situation for us in Game of Thrones. We actually do need to watch season 7.
Yeah. And
yeah, nothing happens in season 7. It's just lots of people just, you know, like, kicking rocks around on the beach.
Maybe a bit of boinking here and there just to keep the fans happy.
Somebody might get sliced and diced. These limbs. There might be fire coming out of some kind of sky lizards.
To be fair, from what I remember at the end of season 6, I don't think any major characters necessarily die from season 7, as far as I could tell. But I could be wrong because I've not, you know, seen that.
Yeah.
Did I say season 6?
Yeah, you said season 6.
What season is...
It's season 8 that's just come out, so we need to watch season 7.
Okay. So, yeah. I was right then. Okay, yeah. Cool.
But, yeah.
Because there's already people, like, that ready to spoil at any moment.
Yeah.
And we cannot have that.
No.
We will have to slap them.
Yes. Or take the Silent Bob and Jay kind of like approach to dealing with them, where you find out where they live and you take a baseball bat and you give them options.
Yeah, but that's like lots of travelling.
A lot of effort. Might have to go on
You've got a car, and you can get one of those easy rail tickets.
That's true. That's if they're in this country.
It's planning ahead, you see.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, other than that, obviously I've been doing the same as Emily when it comes to,
films
and whatnot. And occasionally watching over her shoulder, she plays Captain Toad or Yoshi's Crafted World.
Crafty.
I forgot to say, I got into Pokemon Go.
Oh, yes, you did. And now you're dragging me around town everywhere.
I've yet to decide whether or not I 100% like the game. It's a very different experience because I also have Pokemon Let's Go. But it's a very different experience even from that.
I kind of like the idea of having this kind of game on your mobile phone that you kind of go to real world locations and kind of do stuff like that. But I feel like, there's other games that would benefit from it as well. I still think that maybe like Resident Evil could be quite cool with it.
As long as it's not the new Harry Potter AR game. It's coming out. It'll come out.
Ooh,
I remember.
Ooh, imagine, right? So you have like Resident Evil, doing the, Google, Maps thing. And basically you go to like locations and you actually save people from zombie attacks. That would be quite cool.
That would be. That'd be pretty cool. All right, I think that's all we've got time for this week in this episode. So it is good night from...
It's good night. Goodbye, whatever. From me, Paul Wood. It's been one of those days. I had to chase a bird up the house this morning when I got up, so that was good.
Oh, blimey. What happened?
Thank you, cats. I'll just say that. At least it was alive, so does that. Yeah, anyway.
Presumably you wouldn't be chasing if it was dead.
Well, I could try. It wouldn't be very effective.
Ghost bird?
Sorry, what?
Ghost bird? Zombie bird? Anyway.
White flapper? No, that sounds more like a 1930s dance, the white flapper. Have you seen Deirdre? She's excellent to the white flapper. Anyway, yes, it's good. It's goodbye from me, Paul Wood. I'm Retroid on Eurogamer.net and Super Retroid on Twitter.
And it's good night from me, Paul Blewett. I'm on Twitter's at Paul Blewett.
And it's good night from me, Emily King. I'm on Twitter at EMKingMA. You can find notes for this episode over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Nerds Podcast. We're also on Facebook as Nerds Assemble Podcast. We're on popular, podcast services like iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. And that's it for this week. Good night.
Good night.
Died. Just gonna do the white flapper.
Harder, harder. Easier.
No, that's a different white flapper.
That's Nerds After Dark.